Good morning, everybody. My name is Auriel Miller. I'm the director of the IWRA. And for those of you who may not yet know us, the IWRA is Wales's leading independent think tank. We've got a long track record of shaping debates and influencing change in Wales through policy research and advocacy, our online and print publications. Those of you who are members will be getting the new edition of the Welsh Agenda very soon. We're just putting the finishing touches to it at the moment. This is the current edition, new one coming out in a couple of weeks' time. If you're not yet a member, do join up. We provide platforms for robust comment and debate and our agenda setting events. We're a membership organisation, like I said, members across the country, much further afield too. You may not know that our publications end up in Harvard and MIT libraries. So if you've got a message you want to send far and wide, we're a good place to do it. We're funded by our members, the events we run ourselves, independent trusts and foundations, and other funding bodies as well. So today's event sees the launch of a new report called Stepping Up, which explores the question of what COVID-19 has taught us about the resilience of Welsh places. And it was generously funded by the Carnegie UK Trust. I'll leave it to our panel today to tell you a bit more about the findings in a moment. The IWRA have been involved for some time, and it's been my pleasure to chair the consortium who developed the Understanding Welsh Places website. And Maria is going to put a link in the chat for you now. It's a data website for non-data geeks, and it brings together publicly available data about all places in Wales that have more than 2,000 residents into an accessible and engaging front end. In fact, it has information on places that have 1,000 to 2,000 residents as well, but not all data is available for that band. The potential uses of UWP are numerous, and we've got a whole series of webinars on our website from a festival that we ran about this time last year, actually, in terms of enabling people to see how it could be used. But it all starts fundamentally from the idea that all places have something of value. Everywhere in Wales has assets that people can use to shape the future of that place and their own well-being for the better. During COVID, what places had, whether that was buildings, green spaces, people with the time, means or inclination to help, as well as networks to bring people together, that really, really mattered in a way that we couldn't have anticipated before the pandemic. We believe very firmly that now, with the worst of the pandemic, we hope, behind us, now is the time for the conversation about preparedness. All Welsh places have had their resilience tested and stepped up to the challenge of COVID in their own way. But the question now has to be how we build on that resilience and lay the groundwork for a far more coordinated and better resourced response to the next crisis. So we've produced this piece of work in partnership with The Means, a placemaking consultancy with over 20 years experience of delivering projects in collaboration with businesses, governments and citizens. Peter Williams, founder and managing director of The Means, will be joining us today to share some reflections on what they learned from speaking to people in the private, public and third sector across Wales. Welcome, Peter. We're also joined today by Robin Lovelock, who's got over 20 years experience designing and delivering economic development programmes in Wales and overseas, including in emergency settings in Africa, Asia and the Middle East. Over the last 7 years, however, and particularly during the coronavirus pandemic, Robin's worked with local councils and community groups across North East Wales, strengthening resilience in local food supply chains. She currently works as the North Wales Growth Deal Programme Manager, leading on agri-food and tourism projects across the region, and as a town councillor in Llangollen. Thank you both for joining us today and welcome, Robin. I'm going to hand you over to Andy Regan, who's going to talk a little bit more about the background to the piece of work. But before I do that, a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to be devoting 15, 20 minutes or so of our session today to questions from all of you who've joined us. So if you look at the small menu at the bottom of your Zoom screen, you should be able to see a chat function. Use this obviously to submit questions in writing throughout the event, and we'll call on you individually to ask your question, but worked in your own places, because this is a really good opportunity to hear examples of what worked wherever you are. You're all muted, I'm afraid, on entry to this meeting, but we'll unmute you if you're called on to ask a question. So in order to prevent background noise, please keep yourself muted unless you're asked to speak. Do also obviously use the chat function to provide comments and response to what's being said. Your feedback really helps us develop future programmes and work and reflect on how we're doing things. We know that lots of people, it's a key piece of feedback, that lots of people often find they make really useful connections by attending IWA events, because it's a place that spans public, private, third sector, academia, and community groups and individuals as well. But it's also a place where policy areas come together. So please do feel free to introduce yourself in the chat as well. All chat questions are recorded, and video of today's event will be made available via our YouTube and podcast channels. If you feel inspired to tweet, great. You can at us at IWA_Wales. And we suggest using hashtag understanding Welsh places as a hashtag. I am going to hand over now to Andy and then Peter, who then talk us through the piece of work. Andy, I've touched on it a bit already, but can you start by telling us a bit more about the project as a whole?
Thanks, Oriel. Yeah, so welcome everybody. I'll tell you a bit of the background and then Peter will tell you the detail. So this piece of research kind of started with what on the surface felt like quite a simple question, which is, what has COVID-19 taught us about the resilience of Welsh places? And like most simple questions, it didn't take much kind of interrogation to see that we need to clarify a bit further what our underlying assumptions were before we could go much further. So we had to kind of define what resilience meant. So we conceived of that in terms of the ability of a community to withstand shocks, stress, and challenges, and thinking in terms of resilience also encompassing the ability to adapt and survive adverse circumstances such as environmental, social, or economic shocks, and to cope and thrive given the challenges of everyday life. So in across all those themes, kind of COVID has tested resilience. And the way we've kind of thought about this is COVID, the pandemic has acted as a quite unfortunate, obviously natural experiment, which allows us to potentially compare different places to see how they coped and what helped and hindered them in doing so. And what we're absolutely not trying to do is kind of give a rating for resilience and kind of a ranking of which places kind of coped best and worst. That's not the purpose of the exercise. It's just to kind of look at all the different ways which communities did step up and what they could kind of learn from their own experiences and learn from each other, and what decision makers could learn. So right now, as Oriel said, in October 2021, it feels like the worst of the pandemic may hopefully be over. The temptation might well be to kind of move on. But the response at all level does merit examination, as they not find fault, but just to see what we can learn. So we've worked with the means, again, on a quite small scale piece of work, just to kind of begin pulling on the thread of what we can learn. So the original evidence gathered for the report, as Peter will tell you, is primarily interview-based with representatives of different sectors. And we chose a selection of places from the seven categories that are used by the Understanding Welsh Places website. And if you refer to the kind of the videos that Oriel's mentioned on the website, you can hear a bit more about what those categories are and how we kind of chose them. So the piece of work hasn't aimed to be quantitative or definitive, but just to look closely at more specific examples of how places withstood the challenges of COVID. At the start of this project, I think I was certainly thinking in terms of the physical assets, the individual bits of small local infrastructure, which are kind of counted and recorded on the UWP website. I was thinking we would probably end up telling a story of kind of which assets are most valuable. But in fact, I think what we kind of heard is a little different than what I expected. We've heard significantly more about the kind of use of human assets and people stepping up. It was primarily people that made places resilient, and by and large, they made use of whatever kind of physical infrastructure and state level administrative support they could access in their place. So we've made quite broad recommendations that we'll come back to after Peter's spoken a bit more about what local government and local authorities can do to build on this resilience. But I think there's a larger conclusion that I kind of took away from this work, which is sort of implicit in all the stories we've heard about, but you wouldn't really kind of link it to a specific example. And that to me is that in how we kind of plan the future of our places, we can either prioritize absolute efficiency or resilience, but we can't prioritize both. So we can't overestimate how different the crisis might have looked without the army of volunteers who were suddenly kind of willing and able to be mobilized due to the enforced closure of many workplaces, and obviously the financial support of the furlough scheme, And at a local level, we should be looking at how to be better prepared to harness this support and focus it on what matters most. At a national for Wales, or indeed UK level, why would we not consider looking at more kind of short-term workplace closures and quick deployment of financial support along the model of those furlough schemes to enable people to quickly step up and help their communities respond to, say, flooding or other extreme weather events? That's not a sort of formal recommendation of the report, because we would need to do a lot more thinking about what exactly that looked like, but I think it's something to kind of keep in mind for future. In terms of the physical assets, community halls, centres, parks and other spaces that were repurposed as either food banks, vaccination centres and information hubs, they couldn't have been used for any of those things if they had been shut down, bulldozed and replaced with investment properties over the years that preceded the crisis. We cannot have resilient places without the headroom that comes from spare capacity within the state, within businesses and within civic society. You know, without community halls squatting on land that the market might value more highly as high-rise flats, or without people who are able to help their neighbours because their own kind of short-term financial crisis has been averted by the pooled risk of state social security. So we'll make recommendations that I'll come back to about how people involved in planning can focus their strategic efforts on building and improved resilience at a local level. And all of those efforts can be assisted using the Understanding Welsh Places website, which can help people better understand their own area, neighbouring towns and towns further away with whom they might have more in common than they perhaps realised. The Understanding Welsh Places website also indexes each place according to how independent, interdependent or dependent they are in relation to other towns. And UWP doesn't present being independent as intrinsically positive or negative, but just another factor which helps people understand where they live. But COVID has surely taught us that understanding who we can turn to and what we ourselves have to offer is absolutely a key component of resilience. So we owe it to ourselves and our communities to better evidence and understand what we've learned about resilience in our places and build it in to our societal infrastructure, whether that's physical infrastructure or human infrastructure, you know, with generosity for the future. Because if COVID has taught us anything, it's that we can never know how much we may need those things. So I'm going to hand over to Peter now to talk through some of the more kind of detailed findings of the report, and then I'll come back on again at the end to talk a little more about the kind of headline level recommendations that we've made. Peter, over to you.
Thanks for the introduction, Andy, and good morning, everyone. It's great to see so many people on the Zoom. I think the first thing I'd like to say is that this research was kind of real-time analysis of society's reaction to a kind of black swan event. And that's intriguing in itself, because the fieldwork was probably 3 or 4 or 5 months ago now. And our psyche, our understanding is already kind of modified during that time. You remember that in the early days of the pandemic, commentators were seeing the end of the migration to the cities. The urban population is just about soared past the 50% mark. And here was an event that was going to reverse that. It was being said, but you know, some 18 months later, those predictions are certainly less strident than they were. Even with case numbers approaching, in some instances, exceeding the previous peaks, our behaviours have changed already, I think. As we're told to kind of learn to live with COVID, our masks have slipped to a level of complacency. It would have been hard to predict where we had those kind of visceral fears of the early days walking around kind of haunted, deserted kind of town centres. And vaccination of the population has now made a very different kind of reading. By the time the post-event inquests are concluded, those memories, I think, will be dull. And that was one of the reasons that conducting research at this time felt so important, and we were delighted to have the opportunity to collaborate with Andy and his colleagues, really. So as Andy touched upon, how can you do a kind of comprehensive look at Welsh places, given the resource that was available and the time was available, et cetera. So we took the Understanding Welsh Places categories. We ensured that we had representation across all those categories in the 11 towns chosen, And we also went for some spatial spreads. Most of the nation is covered in some shape or form. And within those towns, we conducted interviews in the different sectors, businesses, council and voluntary representatives, and asked them basically about their experience of the pandemic. Now, this outcome does not claim to be comprehensive, but snapshots can provide insights that serve a different purpose to aggregation, I feel. So as Andy has said, you know, the validity of the conclusions need to be stress tested. Everybody's experience of the pandemic has been an unique one. And we'd argue that responses need to be place-based. Places have responded differently to the pandemic, and some have done better than others. Analysing what's been good practice from one place and assessing its applicability to other places, and doing so while it's fresh in our minds, seems very worthy of effort. I think the key question was around the extent to which community assets aided towns' resilience in the face of the challenges. And as Andy said again, this meant not simply coping, but bouncing back to survive and to thrive then. And following the first round of interviews, the kind of beta round, as we call them, we felt that kind of three strands were becoming into a clearer focus: the role of community facilities, the contribution of organisations, councils, businesses and the community sector, and what we might call social capital. And we refer to it in the report as civic leadership and volunteering. So the first, and I think it's kind of widely felt that in nearly every sector in the nation struggle to find the right balance between risk aversion and offering the right degrees of freedom. Community halls, as we all know, were locked. Urban parks were gated. Access to coastal parks taped off. Even fell walkers famously droned. And in some town centres, emergency tape was wrapped around street furniture to stop people sitting on them. And whilst all this was completely understandable, it obviously proved more difficult to reopen things, to shut them down in the first place. So to start with, I think open spaces were easy to resolve. And one of the lasting legacies may well be that we have a greater appreciation for our parks and open spaces. I think Councillor Joshua Bynan in Pembroke expressed this better than I can, and I'll quote him here. The crisis has shown the need for places to be approached differently, with the key foundations of public space needed to be highlighted and taken more care of. Place was approached through a very physical asset-based means before, whereas now we can see that it needs to have a more common, more focus on community assets. And I think that's kind of spot on. Turning to halls, the risk analysis here was much more problematic, I think, and the burden for it often fell on voluntary committees. I don't know if you came across the document, but the WCVA's guidance on reopening ran to 11 pages, you know, quite terrifying, the responsibility being based on volunteers. And I think one organisation that really kind of responded admirably to it was the Forehead Community Centre and Cafe in Rhyl. Obviously closed, it had to adopt. It began to operate a Meals and Wheels service from the cafe. The centre's food bank started delivering food parcels, using staff and volunteers for shopping and getting prescriptions for isolated individuals. The existing community transport scheme was kind of re-targeted at deliveries, home deliveries, prescriptions and the like. And a simple thing which I hadn't really considered before was that a lot of people claiming benefits have got evidence, job search and so forth. And for lots of people, community facilities are where they get access to the internet. And that caused a kind of real gap. So the breadth of services from these facilities, so essential in particular for the poorer parts of the population, were cut off for a stroke. In our research, we didn't identify any pre-planning which captured the service provision in the first instance. There was no audit of it centrally. And there was no guidance for dealing with circumstances of disruption like the ones we faced. So these facilities are so evidently a resource for crisis management. Currently is left to each of them to innovate and respond, seemingly in the absence of any strategic overview, was our conclusion. Turning to organizational performance, we asked interviewees how they viewed the response to the pandemic. And here there was a diversion of opinion between the sectors. The public sector, by and large, were more positive in their assessment about how the communities had responded than the private sector. There was, though, a lot of praise from businesses for the way that councils had delivered practical financial and advisory support in the crisis. In RCT, for example, a real sense that the council and businesses had come closer together by jointly working their way through the response. Lots of examples of businesses prevented from operating, as Andy said, closed, and switching their operational capacity to undertake community services, meals for the elderly, producing wash bags for NHS workers, and organising deliveries to the housebound. Whereas in Pwllheli, it was a doctor's surgery that came together with the council and other public services to take the lead in alerting the public to the precautions that would be required, utilising, amongst other things, a website called Fresh Air Wales. It'd be interesting to see, at the time when we were talking to them, vaccination rates were very high in that community as the kind of awareness and trust in the response was at a higher level than we found elsewhere. In Port Talbot, we found the efforts based around the mosque particularly noteworthy. They had a strong committee of members who were able to contribute a different skill set, a broad different skill set, helping those living locally, those within the BAME community and those outside. Social media, key tool there in spreading the message. Lots of confusion, as we all experienced, conflicting messages at a national level. And the mosque was very instrumental in working with partners in delivering a clear, consistent and trustworthy voice. And it was called the Tell Me More campaign, and a really good example of good practice there. This notion of trusted voices is particularly relevant to the final points I wanted to make on civic leadership and volunteering, where we do feel there's a real scope to take lessons forward. One question, and I found that Robin is a town councillor, so I'd be very interested to see what she has to say following me. But did the experience of this pandemic change our view of the role of councillors at all? In Bangor, where the city council was very active in their COVID response, the clerk certainly thought so. He believes, I think, that the councillor's position in the community makes them well placed to provide information, support, advice, connections to other services and the like. And this was certainly the case in rural Carmarthenshire, where we looked at Llandeilo and Llandovery, and certainly members were key in a conduit for information and activity. Pwllheli gave us a great example of how volunteers have responded and made a huge contribution. The efforts there were kickstarted in the back of the previous experience of helping the elderly population during the heavy snow, during the Beast of the East, which you all remember. One of the volunteers there had been living in Spain and had an early insight into how the pandemic had spread there. Obviously the communities had faced some terrible problems in the early days. So the need for a coordinated approach amongst key agencies was recognised. They managed to get teams of volunteers up and running very, very quickly to visit members of the community, especially those who are homebound. It was effective action, and it really illustrates the potential that is there. It was interesting to hear that they felt they would have been even more effective had they been able to retain the databases they used in 2018. And it's interesting there how several parts of our current kind of rules and regulations cut across some of those volunteering activities for good reasons, but possibly deserve a revisit. So to end up, I think the forecasters are warning that Black Swan's events are going to be more regular. Financial, meteorological, public health issues, crises are to come. Learning lessons from this pandemic, crucial in building resilience to these future shocks. And I feel that when the question has been asked about how we can improve our response to the next Black Swan event, one of the considerations will be what is the most effective unit to organize resilience around. And I think what I've taken from this is that in the age of the city region, our towns will have a strong case to make in being that kind of unit of organization. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Peter. Good to hear the examples from right around the country. Andy, would you like to talk us through some of the recommendations then as a result, please?
Yeah, thanks, Aurel, and thanks, Peter, for your presentation, obviously to you and the team for all your work on the project too. The recommendations, I'll talk through them fairly briefly, and I'll preface them by saying this. I don't think these are rocket science. I don't think we've come up with anything that is incredibly innovative or unexpected. But what I absolutely think is that this could go two ways at this point. We could either do these things and make sure these things are being done at all levels locally, or we could not. And I think what we're hoping to prompt is a conversation about the need to do these things. And I'm quite sure that people on the call who are involved in local emergency planning will probably be happy to tell me that they are doing lots of these things already, but it's whether they can be done consistently and be done using the kind of the tools available. So, with that caveat, the three things that we're saying need to be done across Wales are, first of all, is to kind of understand local assets and fill the gaps. So as Peter said, audit is a good word to use for this recommendation. I think local authorities and or town and community councils should be undertaking a relatively light touch audit of what the facilities are in their area, with a note on the role that they played in supporting people during COVID-19 and how that might be replicable in similar circumstances. So the example would be, for example, having a food bank in your area. If you needed that before COVID-19, you are not going to need it less during a similar kind of situation. So where that's located is going to be a consideration. If it's in a community hall, if you're, is that community hall vulnerable to flooding, is the kind of obvious example that we've already had to deal with in Wales in recent years. So having kind of done that exercise at a local level, decision makers, planners should be trying to share that learning with similar places. And by similar, I mean, places not just locally, but who share the same kind of UWP category as them, and therefore similar characteristics as a town or as a place, just to understand what additional or different things they could have done that other places maybe came up with. It's probably important also to involve emergency services in their areas in this exercise. And obviously we have a ready-made structure for that in Wales in the form of public service boards. And then finally, that audit exercise should be used to inform proactive decisions about what community facilities they may need to develop to fill the gaps, or just to protect, to make sure that they keep that longer term resilience in future emergencies, and don't get rid of facilities that proved essential during the pandemic. The second thing is make a plan to mobilise people. Peter's talked about volunteering, and that's been a huge emerging theme of the conversations he and his team have had. And I said earlier, COVID created this huge bank of human resource of people who wanted to step up and help, but managing and coordinating volunteers, as many people on this call will know, does itself require significant resources. Volunteers do that, give their time for free, but it's not a free resource to coordinate them. So ideally people need to be mobilized around the most essential tasks, which are kind of strategically important. So part of the process should be, creating like a bank of details of individuals who are kind of potentially able to offer their time or their own facilities if they're a business or something, and who are willing to act as coordinators in the event of an emergency. And as Peter's touched on, some of the people he spoke to, data protection rules were a barrier to them using databases that they'd created in the past. That's not insurmountable, but places probably going to need a bit of help to say, well, this is how you collect and store this sort of database in a way which complies with data regulations and doesn't breach them, so that you can keep it for when it is needed and not have to just kind of start from scratch each time because you're concerned quite rightly about breaching data protection. And the plan that you kind of put in place to kind of mobilize that resource should also kind of carefully consider proportionate ways to ensure safeguarding requirements are taken into account and taken very seriously, as they should be,
but wherever possible can speed up processes to reduce avoidable delays as a result of kind of having to screen people for safeguarding concerns, which I don't think Peter mentioned, but certainly is something that came up in conversations he and I have had. And finally, the kind of sort of second order theme that came out that Peter talked about is communications and local networks. And it's almost, to me, feels more important that the local planners, again, councillors, it may be local authority, local government, are developing networks who can help them get the message out, and that those networks are kind of created and maintained between emergencies, so you're not kind of trying to develop that at the point when you're dealing with lots of other things, because it's that element of trust, and it's almost more important than kind of having a finely crafted leaflet, message, speech that someone's going to do on the television. Is just, this is what everybody needs to know, and these are the right people to get that message out to the different parts of our communities at a local level. Just to make sure you're able to kind of quickly distribute the essential information. And as Peter's alluded to, it can really help with a lot of the misinformation and disinformation issues that in other areas of the IWA's work we've been looking at. And there's certainly lots of evidence of misinformation about vaccines, for example, being circulated in particular communities during the pandemic, which is not helpful to the response or to kind of giving people in communities an idea of what the best thing is for them to do. So as I say, not rocket science to do those things, but I think super important, and hopefully we can prompt a conversation about that being a legitimate use of scarce resources as we kind of enter the post pandemic period.
Andy, thank you. Thanks very much indeed. I think sometimes the simple things are the hardest to do. Robin, I'm going to come to you in a tick. I know Harry's already put a reminder in the chat about questions. Do please have a think about stories that people in your own particular places, of how people stepped up during the pandemic. And if you want to share that, and also think about what we have collectively, or what you have learned from it that you'd like to share with other places across Wales. What I was reflecting on just then, Andy, as you were talking, was, for instance, is there something that we could do to bring together places in different categories across UWP to share those experiences? How is that kind of cross-area learning happening? Or is it all within a local authority? Because often it's that, and the WLG obviously has a key role to play there. Robin, you've got a number of different hats on in this conversation, so I'd like to come to you for your reflections. Maybe starting from your experience as a town councillor, and then we can kind of zoom out to the regional level. What could you share in terms of the most striking examples of people stepping up to help during COVID, and what could the rest of Wales learn from those activities?
Thank you, Auriel, and really a pleasure to have the chance to join the discussion today. So yes, as you mentioned, kind of a number of different hats, and really reflecting as Peter and Andy talking about on the different aspects from my work internationally and locally and regionally. So I think in terms of the local level, I think the report really reflects a lot of my experiences and observations of our local response to the pandemic around Llangollen and the Dee Valley. So very much the critical value of networks. So I think one of the interesting things, going back to what Andy said about the need to learn from this experience as we prepare for the future crises, is that the response in Llangollen very much built on the back of an earlier response to a widespread wildfire that the community have been tackling and volunteers have been tackling over a month-long period, several months prior to COVID. And that had really required a lot of coordination in supporting the volunteer emergency services in fighting that wildfire. So when COVID came along, a lot of those networks were still there and could then be remobilised and engaged in the COVID response. So it really does speak to the need to kind of use this opportunity to prepare. I think one of the critical things, particularly with COVID affecting older people more substantially, I think one of the critical things was also looking at the need for offline communication networks as well as online. And obviously community networks are vital for that. Just sharing information via social media isn't enough to get important messages out. So I think that was key. And then I think one of the more challenging parts for me was really as a town councillor. So you may or may not know, but there are a lot of rules around town councillors and when we convene and how we have to announce that publicly. And so we were actually restricted from meeting partly because of the law, prevented from meeting virtually. And therefore really only able to respond in the first instance as individuals. So even when I knew that I had as the chair of an umbrella group for community groups, that I wasn't able to use that mailing list to get information out because of the GDPR issues that Andy mentioned. So some real, I think, issues that I think we've worked through over the COVID response around virtual meetings of town councils are much more normal now, but those weren't in place previously. But also very much appreciate the recommendation that we need to look at GDPR and how to make that work for emergency situations.
So, you know, you and I have both worked in emergency situations in other countries as well, and often that line of communication gets automatically shortened once a particular scenario has been reached. You know, there's an acknowledgement. We're in the situation, therefore we move to this. What we didn't talk about in the report is the need for economic resilience in the long term. And obviously that's your other hat in terms of the North Wales Economic Ambition Board. Could you tell us a little bit about how the board has responded to COVID, what you're prepping for in the aftermath of both the pandemic itself and also, crucially, the end of the financial support from the Treasury that seen many businesses and people through the crisis. We're obviously, you know, conscious of the end of furlough and also conscious of the end of universal credit, the extra £20 uplift.
Absolutely. And the Economic Ambition Board has been very much at the forefront of the economic response in North Wales. Working very closely in the recovery phase with local authorities who have obviously really led that on a council by council basis. But the regional response has allowed a number of studies to be done into, for example, changes in economic circumstances in different sectors. So doing an analysis of the regional impact of COVID on the critical tourism sector, for example, and similarly for manufacturing, what are the main impacts? How do we envisage the impacts of COVID in the medium to longer term, so that it has allowed and supported the local authorities to prepare for those? And then, of course, looking longer term at a time that's potentially more turbulent, the growth deal itself is comprised of about 20. Different projects looking across the realms of digital land and property, also low carbon energy, agri-food and tourism and manufacturing, and looking at each of the projects and how they're supporting a more resilient future for the region. So obviously with the low carbon energy, looking at how we can better generate energy at a community level, so smart local energy projects rolling out across the region. Digitally, how we can strengthen rural communities, particularly the last few percent that maybe don't have adequate internet access, how we can get those families and households online and make sure that we don't have a digital breakdown as an additional part of any future challenges. And then I think looking at the more kind of supply chain issues as well within the region. So I think if I can just divert to some regional work, I think one of the really exciting things for North East Wales during COVID was that we were able to capture through some videos some of the adaptations that businesses made during that period. So to address the gaps in supermarket food supply. So as part of a project called Taste North East Wales, prior to joining the Economic Ambition Board, I was able to repurpose some funding we already had to capture some of these stories of farm shops stepping up production community shops and town halls operating as food hubs when supermarkets failed, and gin producers shifting to production of hand gel. So we were able to capture these stories and also help those businesses tell the stories about how they were preparing for reopening. And so all of those things were really able to kind of help businesses get back on their feet and step out of the pandemic on a stronger footing. And I think that ties back into the regional work that the Economic Ambition Board is delivering. So, for example, one of the projects is the Glenclevon Rural Economy Hub in West Northwest Wales. And that's very much about setting up a startup space for regional food producers who are maybe shifting from home-based production, but not wanting to invest in their own full-scale manufacturing facilities. And these will provide an initial first step of food grade units to really strengthen regional production and build resilience through those supply chains.
There are some really good examples there. Thank you very much indeed, Robin. I'm going to open it up to conversation with everybody on the call today, because I know there's shed loads of experience with us. David Warren, let's find you and put your video on. We want to hear about, you've been talking about your work on the circular economy. There we go. David, hi. Tell us a bit more about what you've seen and what you've learned.
Yeah, I put a little bit of a long message in there, but my name is David Warren. I'm head of circular economy policy in the Welsh Government. And obviously, we're really interested in seeing a Wales which uses resources more efficiently, reduces waste, that kind of thing. But I think the pandemic has been a really, really interesting experience for us, because what we've seen in many of our towns and communities is really a lot of accelerated action for communities to come together to take action in response to the pandemic, but action that's also improved environmental, social and economic outcomes. Right in the middle of the first lockdown, I did a little bit of a profile of my own community here in Canton in Cardiff, and we started finding things, you know, like businesses like the gin distillery started making hand sanitizer, the dairy started offering more products for delivery, the local shops started developing digital presence, and that really encouraged people to shop locally as we were kind of forced to stay local. We also saw a lot of community action, things like sharing and repairing of goods. So like in lots of communities, we saw Facebook groups and other groups emerge where people were offering items to share, to swap, to sell, that kind of thing. And I think as we've gone through the pandemic, we've seen more and more of that. You know, we work with organisations like Repair Cafe Wales and Benthyg Library of Things, which repair items or have items for loan, for borrowing. And we've seen an interest in their work expand exponentially during the pandemic. And at the last count, there were 60 repair cafes in Wales. And that's grown from about less than half of that before the pandemic. There's a lot more interest in this. And then the final point I was making, that some of our towns seem to have actually used the pandemic to really kind of not just survive, but thrive. And I gave the examples of Buckley and Mold, but I could give other examples in terms of what's going on in Newtown and St Drindod and Haverford West and some other places, where actually you've seen things like, as people have stayed locally and people have sought more local solutions to things and communities have come together, you can see things like real economic opportunities emerge as vacancy rates drop, as footfall increases, as places given over, spaces given over in towns to community spaces. So, for example, things like the Fuse Project in Porthmadog has taken over a shop space where they work with businesses and communities and young people to teach skills of repairing using 3D printers and other kind of sources. But again, filling a space on a high street, which not just young people or the community can use, but businesses can share as well. So there's many, many more initiatives I could talk about. But really what we're seeing is some really fantastic things going on in our towns, which are not just improving our towns, but really improving environmental, social and economic outcomes too.
Thanks, David. I wanted to pick up on sort of what's going on to learn, to sort of do that cross-sector learning and cross-geographical learning as well, because obviously travel isn't circumscribed in the same way as it used to be, but there's still a lot of pressure on delivery of services at a local level. So making the time and the space to do that learning is something we've talked about, needs to be resourced. John, I want to, if I can, come to John Galanders in a minute if he's willing to talk about his example. But maybe, David, you could tell me a bit more about that sort of cross-sector learning, if that's happening.
Yeah, no, it definitely is happening. And I think actually some of the experience from the pandemic, some of those positive community actions that have been taking place have been picked up in the current Welsh Government programme for government. And there are actions in there, for example, to expand repair and reuse hubs and to support 80 of them across Wales. There's support to look at how circular solutions can support some of our town centres. So there is quite a lot of work. We're not doing this work in isolation. We're doing it with our regeneration colleagues and with local authorities and other partners across Wales. So we know that to maximise some of those benefits, it really does involve joining up. You know, two or three years ago in my role in the Welsh Government, we would have solely been focused on things like ensuring that our waste gets collected and that our recycling rates continue to improve. But actually, by taking that more holistic perspective, we can see some of those economic benefits, some of those social benefits I was telling you about. So really under the frame of things like the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, there is a lot of connections being made and collaboration being made to really kind of maximise some of the benefits that we've seen from some of this community action and community response to the pandemic.
Okay, so one of my concerns was always that individual networks and particular sectors were being strengthened, but they were existing ones, not necessarily new people coming into them, and the kind of cross-sector learning wasn't necessarily as good as it could have been. So it's good to hear that that's moving forward. John, can I come to you? Can you talk to us about people, please, and mobilising people, organising people, and that side of things? Because you've got a really good example there from Wrexham, haven't you?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to acknowledge, there was a huge groundswell of people coming forward volunteering at the early part of COVID, but it's also set in the context there were a lot of people who were actually furloughing. So, you know, they had time on their hands, they had the ability to offer support. And equally, I think the fundamental thing was that the old style good neighborliness actually kicked in with so many people. People quite often, when they go into work in the morning, they would see somebody walking with a dog, they would wave to them as they're in their car, got no idea who they are. But actually, during the lockdown period, people started to get to know each other, they knew their neighbours. But one of the most crucial things that we found as a County Voluntary Council, we did go out and recruit large numbers of people, but soon recognised there was a huge groundswell at street level. And what we've done in Wrexham to try and harness that going forward is we've now formed a community response team, which is for volunteers who want to come forward in the event of one-off incidents, whether it be the snow, the floods, areas which have had traditional bad weather incidents. Normally have got their own sort of networks, but there was a need to supplement that. But then there are other things. Robin referenced things like fires. Well, actually, fires can occur at any time, not just mountain fires. It could be property fires, people needing to be relocated, being looked after. There could be energy problems. There could be burst water mains, all types of things like this. And crucially, when incidents occur, people's emotions start running high and they're quite eager to want to take part. But we do need to acknowledge there is a time and a place for volunteers and community members to step forward. If they step forward too early in incidents, then they actually become a burden on the services that are trying to do the first and second tier, the blue lights, the other immediate responders. So having some levels of control in place to be able to say via our community response team to the blue light brigade, right, these are people who are readily available. They're available to the local authority as part of the council response and emergency planning, but they need to be tapped into at the right time, regardless of the level of people's personal emotion. And I think that sometimes drives people forward that we need to be very mindful of. So we're excited the way that that's developing. We have some Welsh Government funding, so we've done first aid training, food hygiene, various other awareness, and crucially things like DBSs. So we now have a bank of people who we've already got listed and covered, and then individual supervisors will be created who will look after groups of about 10 volunteers at a time. So that's the kind of structure that we've now created here in Wrexham.
And what sort of how are you sharing that outside your own local area, through CVC meetings, or through people that you know doing similar things elsewhere? Because, you know, there's that's the sort of prep. Now is the time to be doing it, isn't it? Before we need it again.
Yeah, it's been shared amongst the CVCs, and it's been shared to Welsh governments as well, because of the fact that it was them that actually funded the ability for us to be able to do the free training and the free DBSs to get things off the ground. And we've also purchased some things like the common things like high-vis things, basic first aid kits, so a supervisor can turn up at any incident with his bag of all the bits and pieces. The volunteers come, they get logged in and are then actually managed on that basis. So we have tried to share that information, but happy to discuss how we're doing that with anybody if they want to get in touch with me again, direct offline sometime.
Can you put your contact details, John, in
there? Yeah, we'll do. Yeah, yeah.
That would be great. It's interesting, and just thinking back, Robin, to what you said about local councillors. You know, I didn't particularly see in the part of Cardiff that I live in councillors being any more visible or not. So sometimes that depends on personalities, and sometimes that, I won't say where I live because I wouldn't want to embarrass them. But that whole thing, and John totally recognised that very, very local response was there. In terms of, you know, people setting up a support group to keep an 87-year-old neighbour living on his own, shopped for and supplied all the time, and checking in, making sure that somebody, he spoke to a real person every day, that kind of, you know, that kind of thing, with absolutely no internet access whatsoever, or having Help Cymru do the kind of daily check-in calls and getting him onto that kind of support. Robin, you were just going to come back in on something just then.
No, really, just to reinforce that point, and it was the networks at the end of the day, you know, in identifying those who were most vulnerable. And we were fortunate to have in Llangollen, we're fortunate to have an extensive network of community groups, about 100 at the last count, which is substantial for a community of about 4,000 people. And then the support of other external groups, kind of larger organisations. There was a project going on called Rural Futures, led by 7Y, who were able to do a lot of the linking as well. And so bringing those networks together was critical. I think just addressing John's point about volunteers, I would definitely agree from international work as much as local work about the risk of burnout and addressing how you manage that, particularly in the immediate aftermath of a crisis, maybe something slightly different than COVID, but certainly something I've seen in other environments. And how you manage people's time during that response, when it can be all consuming, to make sure that you're not making a problem worse, but actually addressing what's needed. And then on a longer term basis with volunteers as well, in Llangollen, we're seeing there was so much investment in community support during COVID. I feel like a lot of the community groups, the leadership is now maybe taking a step back, particularly among the older generation, where they've maybe felt that they've done their bit and are now looking for, you know, take a step back, a bit quieter time in the aftermath. And so I do think that succession, thinking about community groups and succession and planning ahead, how we're getting that new training in that John talked about to those groups, so that they don't just fall apart and the valuable support they can provide be lost. So I think that's something to consider.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really useful point, that succession planning kind of thing, because it's a long period of time. And when you work in kind of normal emergency situations and elsewhere, you generally know that this will pass. What we didn't know that with COVID, did we? We didn't know when we'd get to the stage when people would be, you know, what are we at? 75% of the population vaccinated by now, talking about, you know, 12-year-olds and upwards being vaccinated, and largely able to carry out everyday life, but in a very different way still. Jenny Lathwaite's got a really good example about business in the community. Jenny, could you come and tell us about that, please?
Yeah, hopefully I'm not on mute. Thank you for inviting me to talk about it. So Business in the Community is a member-led business organisation promoting responsible business. And as our response to the pandemic, sort of as soon as it was scaling up, we launched something called the National Business Response Network, which was built from scratch as an online platform in a kind of crazily short amount of time, and basically set up as a sort of matchmaking service between businesses, so our members, but the wider business community as well, open to anybody, to use that to register anything that they might like to share, so items that they could donate, services that they could offer, help with sort of logistical issues, all sorts of things, huge range. And at the same time, people could go on as a community group or as a third sector organisation from across the UK and register a need or a want. And we set up a network within BITC of connections managers. So it was a sort of managed process where there was, you know, people actually actively assigning needs to offers and sort of seeing that through. And that was hugely successful. We saw a lot of things come through that that meant we were able to signpost, you know, to get things to where they would be most needed, and where there were asks and needs that weren't instantly matched, you know, our connections managers could go out and actually search for a way to get those matched. So that's the MBRN. It's sort of gone a little dormant now because we've put it into a more like a sleeping phase, and we're focusing more on now where businesses can contribute to upskilling people and offering sort of business mentoring and coaching advice. But what we talked about with the having those networks ready to go, the MBRN is sort of ready to relaunch at any point that it's needed again. So I think that's a really key issue, that now we've built that infrastructure, we're sort of keeping it, you know, ticking over and until the time that we may need it again. So yeah, I don't have all the facts and figures, but happy to follow up if anybody would like to.
Thanks Jenny. Could you put your contact details in the chat, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I've got an offer as well from Harold Jones, who's very happy to come and talk about the COVID impact assessment, looking particularly at the impact on ethnic and minority communities and Welsh-speaking communities, because obviously one of the things that we all know extremely well by now is that different risks compounded each other, and that some people were far, far worse affected because of either their personal situation or their community situation. Harold, over to you.
Hi, yeah, I just thought I'd put it in the chat. If there are colleagues of mine from Newport on the call, I apologise. They probably might be in a better place. Although I'm a Welsh language officer, I sit in a connected communities team, and part of the work we do is look after the ethnic minority and a lot of the groups that are sometimes underrepresented. And as part of COVID, the impact was seen as being higher on those communities. So under the Equality to Protect Characteristics, we undertook a community impact assessment contacting those communities, all virtually, because we had to do so at the time because of COVID. Just looking at the impact it had had, and then we had funding from the Nadine Bevan Health Board to run a participatory budgeting scheme. So a steering group was formed with representatives from all the groups, and there were a grant scheme to help those communities with projects and schemes to help them come out of COVID and look at the impact and how they could help themselves and help the community improve. We ran it quite successfully. There was one bout, we're just going through assessing how those schemes have operated and worked, and we're currently in the process of running another two, one this year and one next year. So we're just setting up the steering groups that will look and set. It's kind of like, I don't know if anybody knows, it was a company called Mutual Gain came in and helped us run it. So there was a steering group with representatives from the different streams who then come up with the rationale and the model and the grant scheme for people applying and assess them. And it's a public event where people sign up virtually. Hopefully we can look at developing that going forward. But then it's the public and the communities that vote on the projects that get the money. And the biggest
that's really interesting how we've heard of that before, and there's been some really good examples of that in North Tyneside, I think, in particular, have done a really good program on that I thought was great. And it kind of speaks also to the Welsh Places Charter that we worked on with a number of people who were involved in the Understanding Welsh Places Consortium. And I've just asked a member of the IWA team to put the link to that in the chat. So that thing about how people have both a say in the decision-making about what is done in their communities to improve their place and their well-being, but also get to shape that in a way and how that should be funding. So some clear recommendations for I think probably Paul Deer, who's been in the meeting, but unfortunately has had to leave. That was really helpful. Thank you very much indeed.
I was just going to say, part of the biggest problem was that the groups we were trying to reach are those that were digitally excluded.
Yeah, of course.
So it kind of helped, but it didn't help. But it's one of those where you have to spend the money and look at the budget. So if anybody's got ideas of how we can develop that, it'd be brilliant. There, thank you.
Great. You're welcome. Thanks very much indeed. These conversations often need a lot longer than we have. I hope that's been a useful addition to the discussion. We'll be sharing, obviously, our report widely. Thank you very much indeed, Peter, to you and the team for working with us on the report, to Carnegie UK Trust for funding it, and Robin, to you for your input today. Our aim at the IWA, in these open events is always to try and identify the issues that need further thought, articulate really clearly what those issues are, and get people thinking about what needs to change, why, and how to do it, very constructively how to do it, so that we can all play our part in making Wales better. If you want to receive early notification of all IWA events and recordings of all of our sessions direct to your inbox, so you don't even need to go and look for them, please do join us as a member on the support page of our website, which is iwa.wales. Jochen Rauer, thank you very much indeed for joining us, and I hope you have a good rest of the day.